shutters. If anyone came along, Dill would ring the bell. Dill raised his right hand. In it was my mother's silver dinner bell. "I'm going around to the side of the house," said Jem. "We looked yesterday from across the street, and there's a shutter loose. Think maybe I can make it stick on the window sill at least." "Jem, now you're in it, and you can't get out of it. You'll just stay in it, Miss Pris." "Okay, okay. But I don't want to watch." "Jem, somebody was..." "Yes, you will. You'll watch the back end of the lot, and Dill's going to watch the front of the house and up the street. And if anybody comes, he'll ring the bell. That clear?" "All right, then. What'd you write him?" Dill said, "We're asking him real politely to come out sometimes and tell us what he does in there. We said we wouldn't hurt him, and we'd buy him an ice cream."
"You all have gone crazy. He'll kill us," Dill said.
"It's my idea. I figure if he'd come out and sit a spell with us, he might feel better."
"How do you know he don't feel good?"
"Well, how'd you feel if you'd been shut up for 100 years with nothing but cats to eat? I bet he's got a beard down to here. Like your daddy's? He ain't got a beard, he..." Dill stopped, as if trying to remember. "Uh-huh, caught you," I said. "You said 'fore you were off the train good, your daddy had a black beard. If it's all the same to you, he shaved it off last summer." "Yeah, and I've got the letter to prove it. He sent me $2, too." "Keep on. I reckon he even sent you a mounted police uniform. That'll never showed up, did it? You just keep on telling him, son." Dill Harris could tell the biggest ones I ever heard. Among other things, he had been up in a mail plane 17 times. He had been to Nova Scotia. He had seen an elephant. And his granddaddy was Brigadier General Joe Wheeler, and left him his sword. "You all hush," said Jem. He scuttled beneath the house and came out with a yellow bamboo pole. "Reckon this is long enough to reach from the sidewalk?" "Anybody who's brave enough to go up and touch the house hadn't ought to use a fishing pole," I said. "Why don't you just knock the front door down?" "This is different," said Jem. "How many times do I have to tell you that?" Dill took a piece of paper from his pocket and gave it to Jem. The three of us walked cautiously toward the old house. Dill remained at the light pole on the front corner of the lot, and Jem and I edged down the sidewalk parallel to the side of the house. I walked beyond Jem and stood where I could see around the curve.
"All clear," I said. "Not a soul in sight."
Jem looked up the sidewalk to Dill, who nodded. Jem attached the note to the end of the fishing pole, let the pole out across the yard, and pushed it toward the window he had selected. The pole lacked several inches of being long enough, and Jem leaned over as far as he could. I watched him making jabbing motions for so long, I abandoned my post and went to him.
"Can't get it off the pole," he muttered. "Or if I get it off, I can't make it stay. Going back down the street, Scout."
I returned and gazed around the curve at the empty road. Occasionally I looked back at Jem, who was patiently trying to place the note on the window sill. It would flutter to the ground, and Jem would jab it up, until I thought if Boo Radley ever received it, he wouldn't be able to read it. I was looking down the street when the dinner bell rang. Shoulder up, I reeled around to face Boo Radley and his bloody fangs. Instead, I saw Dill ringing the bell with all his might in Atticus's face. Jem looked so awful, I didn't have the heart to tell him I told you so. He trudged along, dragging the pole behind him on the sidewalk.
Attica said, "Stop ringing that bell." Dill grabbed the clapper. In the silence that followed, I wished he'd start ringing it again. Atticus pushed his hat to the back of his head and put his hands on his hips. "Jim," he said, "what were you doing?"
"Nothing, sir."
"I don't want any of that. Tell me."
We were just trying to give something to Mr. Radley."
"What were you trying to give him?"
"Just a letter."
"Let me see it." Jem held out a filthy piece of paper. Atticus took it and tried to read it. "Why do you want Mr. Radley to come out?"
Dill said, "We thought he might enjoy us,"
and dried up when Atticus looked at him. "Son," he said to Jem, "I'm going to tell you something, and tell you one time. Stop tormenting that man. That goes for the other two of you. What Mr. Radley did was his own business. If he wanted to come out, he would. If he wanted to stay inside his own house, he had the right to stay inside, free from the attentions of inquisitive children, which was a mild term for the likes of us. How would we like it if Atticus barged in on us without knocking when we were in our rooms at night? We were, in effect, doing the same thing to Mr. Radley. What Mr. Radley did might seem peculiar to us, but it did not seem peculiar to him. Furthermore, had it never occurred to us that the civil way to communicate with another being was by the front door instead of a side window? Lastly, we were to stay away from that house until we were invited there. We were not to play an asinine game he had seen us playing, or make fun of anybody on this street or in this town. We weren't making fun of him. We weren't laughing at him," said Jem. "We were just..."
"So that was what you were doing, wasn't it?"
"Making fun of him?"
"No," said Atticus. "Putting his life's history on display for the edification of the neighborhood." Jem seemed to swell a little.
"I didn't say we were doing that. I didn't say it."
Atticus grinned dryly. "You just told me," he said. "You stop this nonsense right now. Every one of you." Jem gaped at him.
"You want to be a lawyer, don't you?"
Our father's mouth was suspiciously firm, as if he were trying to hold it in line. Jem decided there was no point in quibbling, and was silent. When Atticus went inside the house to retrieve a file he had forgotten to take to work that morning, Jem finally realized that he had been done in by the oldest lawyer's trick on record. He waited a respectful distance from the front steps, watched Atticus leave the house and walk toward town. When Atticus was out of earshot, Jem yelled after him,
"I thought I wanted to be a lawyer, but I ain't so sure now."
Chapter 6. "Yes," said our father, when Jem asked him if we could go over and sit by Miss Rachel's fish pool with Dill, as this was his last night in Macomb. "Tell him so long for me, and we'll see him next summer." We leaped over the low wall that separated Miss Rachel's yard from our driveway. Jem whistled Bob White, and Dill answered in the darkness.
"Not a breath blowing," said Jem. "Look a-yonder."
He pointed to the east. A gigantic moon was rising behind Miss Maudie's pecan trees.
"That makes it seem hotter," he said.
"Cross in it tonight?" asked Dill, not looking up. He was constructing a cigarette from newspaper and string.
"No, just the lady." "Don't light that thing, Dill. You'll stink up this whole end of town."
There was a lady in the moon in Macomb. She sat at a dresser, combing her hair.
"We're gonna miss you, boy," I said. "Reckon we better watch for Mr. Avery?" Mr. Avery boarded across the street from Mrs. Henry Lafayette DeBose's house. Besides making change in the collection plate every Sunday, Mr. Avery sat on the porch every night until 9 o'clock and sneezed. One evening we were privileged to witness a performance by him which seemed to have been his positively last, for he never did it again, so long as we watched. Jem and I were leaving Miss Rachel's front steps one night when Dill stopped us.
"Golly, look a yonder!"
He pointed across the street. At first we saw nothing but a kudzu-covered front porch, but a closer inspection revealed an arc of water descending from the leaves and splashing in the yellow circle of the streetlight, some 10 feet from source to earth, it seemed to us. Jem said Mr. Avery misfigured. Dill said he must drink a gallon a day. And the ensuing contest to determine relative distances and respective prowess only made me feel left out again, as I was untalented in this area. Dill stretched, yawned, and said altogether too casually, "I know what. Let's go for a walk." He sounded fishy to me. Nobody in Macomb just went for a walk. "Where to, Dill?" Dill jerked his head in a southerly direction. Jem said, "Okay." When I protested, he said sweetly, "You don't have to come along, Angel May."
"You don't have to go, remember?"
Jem was not one to dwell on past defeats. It seemed the only message he got from Atticus was insight into the art of cross-examination.
"Scout, we ain't gonna do anything. We're just going to the streetlight and back."
We strolled silently down the sidewalk, listening to porch swings creaking with the weight of the neighborhood, listening to the soft night murmurs of the grown people on our street. Occasionally, we heard Miss Stephanie Crawford laugh. "Well," said Dill.
"Okay," said Jem. "Why don't you go on home, Scout?"
"What are you gonna do?" Dill and Jem were simply going to peep in the window with the loose shutter to see if they could get a look at Boo Radley. And if I didn't want to go with them, I could go straight home and keep my fat, flopping mouth shut. That was all.
"But what in the Sam Holy Hill did you wait till tonight?"
"Because nobody could see them at night. Because Atticus would be so deep in a book, he wouldn't hear the kingdom coming. Because if Boo Radley killed them, they'd miss school instead of vacation.
And because it was easier to see inside a dark house in the dark than in the daytime. Did I understand?" "Jem, please!"
"Scout, I'm telling you for the last time. Shut your trap or go home.
I declare to the Lord, you're getting more like a girl every day."
With that, I had no option but to join them. We thought it was better to go under the high wire fence at the rear of the Radley lot. We stood less chance of being seen. The fence enclosed a large garden and a narrow wooden outhouse. Jem held up the bottom wire and motioned Dill under it. I followed and held up the wire for Jem. It was a tight squeeze for him.
"Don't make a sound," he whispered. "Don't get in a row of collards, whatever you do. They'll wake the dead."
With this thought in mind, I made perhaps one step per minute. I moved faster when I saw Jem far ahead, beckoning in the moonlight. We came to the gate that divided the garden from the backyard. Jem touched it. The gate squeaked.
"Spit on it,"
whispered Dill.
"You got us in our box, Jem," I muttered. "We can't get out of here so easy. Shh! Spit on it, Scout!"
We spat ourselves dry, and Jem opened the gate slowly,
lifting it aside and resting it on the fence. We were in the backyard. The back of the Radley house was less inviting than the front. A ramshackle porch ran the width of the house. There were two doors and two dark windows between the doors. Instead of a column, a rough 2x4 supported one end of the roof. An old Franklin stove sat in a corner of the porch. Above it, a hat-rack mirror caught the moon and shone eerily.
"Arr!" said Jem softly, lifting his foot. "Smatter! Chickens!" he breathed.
That we would be obliged to dodge the unseen from all directions was confirmed when Dill, ahead of us, spelled G-O-D in a whisper. We crept to the side of the house, around to the window with the hanging shutter. The sill was several inches taller than Jem.
"Give you a hand up," he muttered to Dill. "Wait, though."
Jem grabbed his left wrist and my right wrist. I grabbed my left wrist and Jem's right wrist. We crouched, and Dill sat on our saddle. We raised him, and he caught the window sill.
"Hurry," Jem whispered. "We can't last much longer."
Dill punched my shoulder, and we lowered him to the ground.
"What did you see?"
"Nothing.
Curtains.
There's a little teeny light way off somewhere, though."
"Let's get away from here," breathed Jem. "Let's go round and back again."
"Shh,"
he warned me as I was about to protest.
"Let's try the back window."
"Dill, no,"
I said.
Dill stopped and let Jem go ahead. When Jem put his foot on the bottom step, the step squeaked. He stood still, then tried his weight by degrees. The step was silent. Jem skipped two steps, put his foot on the porch, heaved himself to it, and teetered a long moment. He regained his balance and dropped to his knees. He crawled to the window, raised his head, and looked in. Then I saw the shadow. It was the shadow of a man with a hat on. At first I thought it was a tree, but there was no wind blowing, and tree trunks never walked. The back porch was bathed in moonlight, and the shadow, crisp as toast, moved across the porch toward Jem. Dill saw it next. He put his hands to his face. When it crossed Jem, Jem saw it. He put his hands over his head and went rigid. The shadow stopped about a foot beyond Jem. Its arm came out from its side, dropped, and was still. Then it turned and moved back across Jem, walked along the porch and off the side of the house, returning as it had come. Jem leaped off the porch and galloped toward us. He flung open the gate, danced Dill and me through, and shooed us between two rows of swishing collards. Halfway through the collards, I tripped. As I tripped, the roar of a shotgun shattered the neighborhood. Dill and Jem dived beside me. Jem's breath came in sobs. "Fence by the schoolyard! Hurry, Scout!" Jem held the bottom wire. Dill and I rolled through and were halfway to the shelter of the schoolyard's solitary oak when we sensed that Jem was not with us. We ran back and found him struggling in the fence, kicking his pants off to get loose. He ran to the oak tree in his shorts. Safely behind it, we gave way to numbness, but Jem's mind was racing. "We gotta get home. They'll miss us." We ran across the schoolyard, crawled under the fence to Deer's pasture behind our house, climbed our back fence, and were at the back steps before Jem would let us pause to rest. Respiration normal, the three of us strolled as casually as we could to the front yard. We looked down the street and saw a circle of neighbors at the Radley front gate. We better go down there, said Jem. They'll think it's funny if we don't show up.
Mr. Nathan Radley was standing inside his gate, a shotgun broken across his arm. Atticus was standing beside Miss Morty and Miss Stephanie Crawford. Miss Rachel and Mr. Avery were nearby. None of them saw us come up. We eased in beside Miss Morty, who looked around.
Where were you all? Didn't you hear the commotion?
What happened? Asked Jem. Mr. Radley shot at a Negro in his collared patch.
Oh, did he hit him?
No, said Miss Stephanie. Shot in the air. Scared him pale, though. Says if anybody sees a white nigger around, that's the one. Says he's got the other barrel waiting for the next sound he hears in that patch, and next time he won't aim high, be it dog, nigger, or...
Jem Finch!
Ma'am? Asked Jem.
Atticus spoke. Where are your pants, son?
Pants, sir?
Pants. It was no use. In his shorts, before God and everybody. I sighed.
Mr. Finch?
In the glare from the streetlight, I could see Dill hatching one. His eyes widened, his fat cherub face grew rounder.
What is it, Dill? Asked Atticus.
I won 'em from him,
he said vaguely.
Won them? How?
Dill's hand sought the back of his head. He brought it forward and across his forehead.
We were playing strip poker up yonder by the fish pool, he said.
Jem and I relaxed. The neighbors seemed satisfied. They all stiffened. But what was strip poker? We had no chance to find out. Miss Rachel went off like the town fire siren.
Do Jesus, Dill Harris! Gambling by my fish pool? I'll strip poker you, sir!
Atticus saved Dill from immediate dismemberment. Just a minute, Miss Rachel, he said. I've never heard of 'em doing that before. Were you all playing cards? Jem fielded Dill's fly with his eyes shut.
No, sir, just with matches.
I admired my brother. Matches were dangerous, but cards were fatal.
Jem, Scout, said Atticus, I don't want to hear of poker in any form again. Go buy Dills and get your pants, Jem. Settle it yourselves.
Don't worry, Dill, said Jem as we trotted up the sidewalk. She ain't gonna get you. He'll talk her out of it.
That was fast thinking, son.
Listen, you hear?
We stopped and heard Atticus's voice. Not serious. They all go through it, Miss Rachel. Dill was comforted, but Jem and I weren't. There was the problem of Jem showing up some pants in the morning.
"It'd give you some of mine," said Dill as we came to Miss Rachel's steps.
Jem said he couldn't get in them, but thanks anyway.
We said goodbye, and Dill went inside the house. He evidently remembered he was engaged to me, for he ran back out and kissed me swiftly in front of Jem.
"Y'all right here?"
he bawled after us.
This ends Disc 2. To Kill a Mockingbird, Disc 3.
Had Jem's pants been safely on him, we would not have slept much anyway. Every night sound I heard from my cot on the back porch was magnified threefold. Every scratch of feet on gravel was Boo Radley seeking revenge. Every passing Negro laughing in the night was Boo Radley loose and after us. Insects splashing against the screen were Boo Radley's insane fingers picking the wire to pieces. The chinaberry trees were malignant, hovering. Alive. I lingered between sleep and wakefulness until I heard Jem murmur, "Sleep, little three eyes?
Are you crazy?
Shh,
Atticus's lights out.
In the waning moonlight, I saw Jem swing his feet to the floor.
"I'm going after him," he said.
I sat upright.
"You can't! I won't let you!"
He was struggling into his shirt.
"I've got to."
"You do, and I'll wake up Atticus."
"You do, and I'll kill you."
I pulled him down beside me on the cot. I tried to reason with him.
"Mr. Nathan's gonna find him in the morning, Jem. He knows you lost him. When he shows him to Atticus, it'll be pretty bad. That's all there is to it. Go on back to bed."
"That's what I know," said Jem.
"That's why I'm going after him."
I began to feel sick. Going back to that place by himself? I remembered Miss Stephanie.
Mr. Nathan had the other barrel waiting for the next sound he heard, be it nigger, dog. Jem knew that better than I.
I was desperate.
"Look, it ain't worth it, Jem. A licking hurts, but it doesn't last. You'll get your head shot off, Jem. Please."
He blew out his breath patiently.
"It's like this, Scout," he muttered. "Atticus ain't ever whipped me since I can remember. I want to keep it that way."
This was a thought. It seemed that Atticus threatened us every other day.
"You mean he's never caught you at anything?"
"Maybe so, but I just want to keep it that way, Scout.
We shouldn't have done that tonight, Scout."
It was then, I suppose, that Jem and I first began to part company. Sometimes I did not understand him, but my periods of bewilderment were short-lived. This was beyond me.
"Please," I pleaded, "can't you just think about it for a minute? By yourself on that place? Shut up! It's not like he'd never speak to you again or something. I'm going to wake him up, Jem. I swear I am."
Jem grabbed my pajama collar and wrenched it tight.
"Then I'm going with you," I choked. "No, you ain't. You'll just make noise."
It was no use. I unlatched the back door and held it while he crept down the steps. It must have been 2 o'clock. The moon was setting, and the latticework shadows were fading into fuzzy nothingness. Jem's white shirt tail dipped and bobbed like a small ghost dancing away to escape the coming morning. A faint breeze stirred and cooled the sweat running down my sides. He went the back way, through Deer's pasture, across the schoolyard, and around to the fence, I thought. At least that was the way he was headed. It would take longer, so it was not time to worry yet. I waited until it was time to worry, and listened for Mr. Radley's shotgun. Then I thought I heard the back fence squeak. It was wishful thinking. Then I heard Atticus cough. I held my breath. Sometimes when we made a midnight pilgrimage to the bathroom, we would find him reading. He said he often woke up during the night, checked on us, and read himself back to sleep. I waited for his light to go on, straining my eyes to see it flood the hall. It stayed off, and I breathed again. The night crawlers had retired, but ripe china berries drummed on the roof when the wind stirred, and the darkness was desolate with the barking of distant dogs. There he was, returning to me. His white shirt bobbed over the back fence and slowly grew larger. He came up the back steps, latched the door behind him, and sat on his cot. Wordlessly, he held up his pants. He lay down, and for a while I heard his cot trembling. Soon he was still. I did not hear him stir again. Chapter 7. Jem stayed moody and silent for a week. As Atticus had once advised me to do, I tried to climb into Jem's skin and walk around in it. If I had gone alone to the Radley place at 2 in the morning, my funeral would have been held the next afternoon. So I left Jem alone and tried not to bother him. School started. The second grade was as bad as the first, only worse. They still flashed cards at you and wouldn't let you read or write. Miss Caroline's progress next door could be estimated by the frequency of laughter. However, the usual crew had flunked the first grade again and were helpful in keeping order. The only thing good about the second grade was that this year I had to stay as late as Jem, and we usually walked home together at 3 o'clock. One afternoon, when we were crossing the schoolyard toward home, Jem suddenly said, "There's something I didn't tell you." As this was his first complete sentence in several days, I encouraged him.
"About what?"
"About that night."
"You've never told me anything about that night," I said.
Jem waved my words away as if fanning gnats. He was silent for a while. Then he said, "When I went back for my breeches, they were all in a tangle when I was getting out of them. I couldn't get them loose. When I went back," Jem took a deep breath, "when I went back, they were folded across the fence, like they were expecting me."
"A cross and something else."
Jem's voice was flat. "Show you when we get home. They'd been sewed up. Not like a lady sewed 'em, like something I'd try to do. All crooked. It's almost like
somebody knew you were coming back for 'em."
Jem shuddered. "Like somebody was reading my mind. Like somebody could tell what I was going to do."
"Can't anybody tell what I'm going to do lest they know me, can they, Scout?"
Jem's question was an appeal. I reassured him.
"Can't anybody tell what you're going to do lest they live in the house with you? And even I can't tell sometimes."
We were walking past our tree. In its knothole rested a ball of gray twine.
"Don't take it, Jem," I said. "This is somebody's hiding place."
"I don't think so, Scout."
"Yes, it is. Somebody like Walter Cunningham comes down here every recess and hides his things, and we come along and take 'em away from him. Listen, let's leave it and wait a couple of days. If it ain't gone then, we'll take it, okay?"
"Okay, you might be right," said Jem. "It must be some little kid's place. Hides his things from the bigger folks. You know it's only when school's in that we've found things."
"Yeah," I said, "but we never go by here in the summertime."
We went home. Next morning, the twine was where we had left it. When it was still there on the third day, Jem pocketed it. From then on, we considered everything we found in the knothole our property. The second grade was grim, but Jem assured me that the older I got, the better school would be. That he started off the same way, and it was not until one reached the sixth grade that one learned anything of value. The sixth grade seemed to please him from the beginning. He went through a brief Egyptian period that baffled me. He tried to walk flat a great deal, sticking one arm in front of him and one in back of him, putting one foot behind the other. He declared Egyptians walked that way. I said if they did, I didn't see how they got anything done. But Jem said they accomplished more than the Americans ever did. They invented toilet paper and perpetual embalming, and asked where would we be today if they hadn't. Atticus told me to delete the adjectives, and I'd have the facts. There are no clearly defined seasons in South Alabama. Summer drifts into autumn, and autumn is sometimes never followed by winter, but turns to a days-old spring that melts into summer again. That fall was a long one, hardly cool enough for a light jacket. Jem and I were trotting in our orbit one mild October afternoon when our knothole stopped us again. Something white was inside this time. Jem let me do the honors. I pulled out two small images carved in soap. One was the figure of a boy. The other wore a crude dress. Before I remembered that there was no such thing as hoodooing, I shrieked and threw them down. Jem snatched them up. "What's the matter with you?" he yelled. He rubbed the figures free of red dust. "These are good," he said. "I've never seen any of these good." He held them down to me. They were almost perfect miniatures of two children. The boy had on shorts, and a shock of soapy hair fell to his eyebrows. I looked up at Jem. A point of straight brown hair kicked downwards from his part. I had never noticed it before. Jem looked from the girl doll to me. The girl doll wore bangs. So did I. "These are us," he said. "Who did 'em, you reckon?" "Who do we know around here who whittles?" he asked. "Mr. Avery." "Mr. Avery just does like this. I mean carves." Mr. Avery averaged a stick of stove wood per week. He honed it down to a toothpick and chewed it. "There's old Miss Stephanie Crawford's sweetheart," I said. "He carves all right, but he lives down the country. When would he ever pay any attention to us?" "Maybe he sits on the porch and looks at us instead of Miss Stephanie. If I was him, I would." Jem stared at me so long I asked what was the matter, but got "Nothing, Scout," for an answer. When we went home, Jem put the dolls in his trunk. Less than 2 weeks later, we found a whole package of chewing gum, which we enjoyed. The fact that everything on the Radley place was poison having slipped Jem's memory. The following week, the knothole yielded a tarnished medal. Jem showed it to Atticus, who said it was a spelling medal, that before we were born, the Macomb County schools had spelling contests and awarded medals to the winners. Atticus said someone must have lost it, and had we asked around? Jem camel-kicked me when I tried to say where we had found it. Jem asked Atticus if he remembered anybody who ever won one, and Atticus said no. Our biggest prize appeared 4 days later. It was a pocket watch that wouldn't run on a chain with an aluminum knife. "You reckon it's white gold, Jem?" "Don't know. I'll show it to Atticus." Atticus said it would probably be worth $10, knife, chain, and all, if it were new. "Did you swap with somebody at school?" he asked.
"Oh, no, sir."
Jem pulled out his grandfather's watch that Atticus let him carry once a week, if Jem were careful with it. On the days he carried the watch, Jem walked on eggs. "Atticus, if it's all right with you, I'd rather have this one instead. Maybe I can fix it." When the new wore off his grandfather's watch, and carrying it became a day's burdensome task, Jem no longer felt the necessity of ascertaining the hour every 5 minutes. He did a fair job, only one spring and two tiny pieces left over, but the watch would not run. "Oh," he sighed, "it'll never go." "Scout, huh? You reckon we ought to write a letter to whoever's leaving us these things?"
"That'd be right nice, Jem. We can thank 'em." "What's wrong?"
Jem was holding his ears, shaking his head from side to side.
"I don't get it.
I just don't get it. I don't know why, Scout.
He looked toward the living room.
I've got a good mind to tell Atticus.
No, I reckon not.
I'll tell him for you.
No, don't do that, Scout.
Scout, what?
He had been on the verge of telling me something all evening. His face would brighten, and he would lean toward me. Then he would change his mind. He changed it again.
Oh, nothing. Here, let's write a letter.
I pushed a tablet and pencil under his nose.
Okay. Dear Mister...
How do you know it's a man? I bet it's Miss Morty. Been betting that for a long time.
Aw, Miss Morty can't chew gum.
Jem broke into a grin.
You know, she can talk real pretty sometimes. One time I asked her to have a chew, and she said, no thanks, that chewing gum cleaved to her palate and rendered her speechless, said Jem carefully.
Doesn't that sound nice?
Yeah, she can say nice things sometimes. She wouldn't have a watch and chain anyway.
Dear Sir, said Jem, we appreciate the... No, we appreciate everything which you have put into the tree for us. Yours very truly, Jeremy Atticus Finch.
He won't know who you are if you sign it like that, Jem.
Jem erased his name and wrote, Jem Finch. I signed, Jean Louise Finch, Scout, beneath it. Jem put the note in an envelope. Next morning, on the way to school, he ran ahead of me and stopped at the tree. Jem was facing me when he looked up, and I saw him go stark white.
Scout!
I ran to him. Someone had filled our knothole with cement.
Don't you cry now, Scout. Don't cry now. Don't you worry.
He muttered at me all the way to school. When we went home for dinner, Jem bolted his food, ran to the porch, and stood on the steps. I followed him.
Hasn't passed by yet, he said.
Next day, Jem repeated his vigil and was rewarded.
"How did you, Mr. Nathan?" he said.
"Morning, Jem, Scout,"
said Mr. Radley as he went by.
"Mr. Radley," said Jem.
Mr. Radley turned around.
"Mr. Radley, did you put cement in that hole in that tree down yonder?"
"Yes," he said. I filled it up.
Why'd you do it, sir?
Trees dying. You plug 'em with cement when they're sick. You ought to know that, Jem.
Jem said nothing more about it until late afternoon. When we passed our tree, he gave it a meditative pat on its cement and remained deep in thought. He seemed to be working himself into a bad humor, so I kept my distance. As usual, we met Atticus coming home from work that evening. When we were at our steps, Jem said,
Atticus, look down yonder at that tree, please, sir.
What tree, son?
The one on the corner of the Radley lot coming from school.
Yes.
Is that tree dying?
Why, no, son, I don't think so. Look at the leaves. They're all green and full. No brown patches anywhere.
It ain't even sick.
That tree's as healthy as you are, Jem. Why?
Mr. Nathan Radley said it was dying.
Well, maybe it is. I'm sure Mr. Radley knows more about his trees than we do.
Atticus left us on the porch. Jem leaned on a pillar, rubbing his shoulders against it.
"Do you itch, Jem?"
I asked, as politely as I could. He did not answer.
"Come on in, Jem,"
I said. After a while. He stood there until nightfall, and I waited for him. When we went in the house, I saw he had been crying. His face was dirty in the right places, but I thought it odd that I had not heard him. Chapter 8. For reasons unfathomable to the most experienced prophets in Macomb County, autumn turned to winter that year. We had 2 weeks of the coldest weather since 1885, Atticus said. Mr. Avery said it was written on the Rosetta Stone that when children disobeyed their parents, smoked cigarettes, and made war on each other, the seasons would change. Jem and I were burdened with the guilt of contributing to the aberrations of nature, thereby causing unhappiness to our neighbors and discomfort to ourselves. Old Mrs. Radley died that winter, but her death caused hardly a ripple. The neighborhood seldom saw her, except when she watered her cannas. Jem and I decided that Boo had got her at last, but when Atticus returned from the Radley house, he said she died of natural causes, to our disappointment.
"Ask him," Jem whispered. "You ask him. You're the oldest. That's why you ought to ask him."
"Atticus," I said, "did you see Mr. Arthur?" Atticus looked sternly around his newspaper at me. "I did not." Jem restrained me from further questions. He said Atticus was still touchous about us and the Radleys, and it wouldn't do to push him any. Jem had a notion that Atticus thought our activities that night last summer were not solely confined to strip poker. Jem had no firm basis for his ideas. He said it was merely a twitch. Next morning I awoke, looked out the window, and nearly died of fright. My screams brought Atticus from his bathroom half-shaven.
"The world's ending, Atticus! Please do something!"
I dragged him to the window and pointed. "No, it's not," he said. "It's snowing." Jem asked Atticus, would it keep up? Jem had never seen snow either, but he knew what it was. Atticus said he didn't know any more about snow than Jem did. "I think, though, if it's watery like that, it'll turn to rain." The telephone rang, and Atticus left the breakfast table to answer it. "That was Eula May," he said when he returned. "I quote, 'As it has not snowed in Macomb County since 1885, there will be no school today.'" Eula May was Macomb's leading telephone operator. She was entrusted with issuing public announcements, wedding invitations, setting off the fire siren, and giving first aid instructions when Dr. Reynolds was away. When Atticus finally called us to order and bade us look at our plates instead of out the windows, Jem asked, "How do you make a snowman?"
"I haven't the slightest idea," said Atticus. "I don't want you all to be disappointed, but I doubt if there'll be enough snow for a snowball even."
Calpurnia came in and said she thought it was sticking. When we ran to the backyard, it was covered with a feeble layer of soggy snow.
"We shouldn't walk about in it," said Jem. "Look, every step you take's wasting it."
I looked back at my mushy footprints. Jem said if we waited until it snowed some more, we could scrape it all up for a snowman. I stuck out my tongue and caught a fat flake. It burned.
"Jem, it's hot."
"No, it ain't. It's so cold it burns.
Now don't eat it, Scout. You're wasting it. Let it come down."
"But I want to walk in it."
"I know what. We can go walk over at Miss Morty's."
Jem hopped across the front yard. I followed in his tracks. When we were on the sidewalk in front of Miss Morty's, Mr. Avery accosted us. He had a pink face and a big stomach below his belt. "See what you've done," he said. "Hasn't snowed in Macomb since Appomattox. It's bad children like you makes the seasons change."
I wondered if Mr. Avery knew how hopefully we had watched last summer for him to repeat his performance, and reflected that if this was our reward, there was something to say for sin. I did not wonder where Mr. Avery gathered his meteorological statistics. They came straight from the Rosetta Stone.
"Jem Finch! You Jem Finch!"
"Miss Maudie's calling you, Jem."
"You all stay in the middle of the yard. There's some thrift buried under the snow near the porch. Don't step on it."
"Yes'm," called Jem. "It's beautiful, ain't it, Miss Maudie?"
"Beautiful, my hind foot. If it freezes tonight, it'll carry off all my azaleas."
Miss Maudie's old sun hat glistened with snow crystals. She was bending over some small bushes, wrapping them in burlap bags. Jem asked her what she was doing that for.
"Keep 'em warm," she said.
"How can flowers keep warm? They don't circulate."
"I cannot answer that question, Jem Finch. All I know is if it freezes tonight, these plants'll freeze. So you cover 'em up. Is that clear?"
"Yes'm."
"Miss Maudie?"
"What, sir?"
"Could Scout and me borrow some of your snow?"
"Heavens alive, take it all. There's an old peach basket under the house. Haul it off in that."
Miss Maudie's eyes narrowed.
"Jem Finch, what are you going to do with my snow?"
"You'll see," said Jem, and we transferred as much snow as we could from Miss Maudie's yard to ours. A slushy operation.
"What are we going to do, Jem?" I asked.
"You'll see," he said. "Now get the basket and haul all the snow you can rake up from the backyard to the front. Walk back in your tracks, though," he cautioned.
"Are we going to have a snow baby, Jem?"
"No, a real snowman. Got to work hard now."
Jem ran to the backyard, produced the garden hoe, and began digging quickly behind the woodpile, placing any worms he found to one side. He went in the house, returned with the laundry hamper, filled it with earth, and carried it to the front yard. When we had 5 baskets of earth and 2 baskets of snow, Jem said we were ready to begin.
"Don't you think this is kind of a mess?" I asked.
"Looks messy now, but it won't later," he said.
Jem scooped up an armful of dirt, patted it into a mound on which he added another load, and another, until he had constructed a torso.
"Jem, I ain't ever heard of a nigger snowman," I said.
"He won't be black long," he grunted.
Jem procured some peach tree switches from the backyard, platted them, and bent them into bones to be covered with dirt.
"He looks like Stephanie Crawford with her hands on her hips," I said. "Fat in the middle, and little bitty arms."
"I'll make 'em bigger."
Jem sloshed water over the mud man and added more dirt. He looked thoughtfully at it for a moment. Then he molded a big stomach below the figure's waistline. Jem glanced at me, his eyes twinkling.
"Mr. Avery's sort of shaped like a snowman, ain't he?"
Jem scooped up some snow and began plastering it on. He permitted me to cover only the back, saving the public parts for himself. Gradually, Mr. Avery turned white. Using bits of wood for eyes, nose, mouth, and buttons, Jem succeeded in making Mr. Avery look cross. A stick of stove wood completed the picture. Jem stepped back and viewed his creation.
"It's lovely, Jem," I said. "Looks almost like he'd talk to you."
"It is, ain't it?" he said shyly.
We could not wait for Atticus to come home for dinner, but called and said we had a big surprise for him. He seemed surprised when he saw most of the backyard and the front yard, but he said we had done a jim-dandy job.
"I didn't know how you were going to do it," he said to Jem, "but from now on, I'll never worry about what'll become of you, son." You'll always have an idea.
Jem's ears reddened from Atticus's compliment, but he looked up sharply when he saw Atticus stepping back. Atticus squinted at the snowman a while. He grinned, then laughed.
Son, I can't tell what you're going to be. An engineer, a lawyer, or a portrait painter. You've perpetrated a near libel here in the front yard. We've got to disguise this fellow.
Atticus suggested that Jem hone down his creation's front a little, swap a broom for the stove wood, and put an apron on him. Jem explained that if he did, the snowman would become muddy and cease to be a snowman.
I don't care what you do, so long as you do something, said Atticus. You can't go around making caricatures of the neighbors.
Ain't a caricature, said Jem. It looks just like him.
Mr. Avery might not think so.
I know what, said Jem. He raced across the street, disappeared into Miss Morty's backyard, and returned triumphant. He stuck her sun hat on the snowman's head and jammed her hedge clippers into the crook of his arm.
Atticus said that would be fine.
Miss Morty opened her front door and came out on the porch. She looked across the street at us. Suddenly she grinned.
Jem Finch, she called. You devil! Bring me back my hat, sir!
Jem looked up at Atticus, who shook his head. She's just fussing, he said. She's really impressed with your accomplishments. Atticus strolled over to Miss Morty's sidewalk, where they engaged in an arm-waving conversation, the only phrase of which I caught was,
"Erected an absolute morphodite in that yard. Atticus, you'll never raise 'em."
The snow stopped in the afternoon, the temperature dropped, and by nightfall Mr. Avery's direst predictions came true. Calpurnia kept every fireplace in the house blazing, but we were cold. When Atticus came home that evening, he said we were in for it, and asked Calpurnia if she wanted to stay with us for the night. Calpurnia glanced up at the high ceilings and long windows and said she thought she'd be warmer at her house. Atticus drove her home in the car. Before I went to sleep, Atticus put more coal on the fire in my room. He said the thermometer registered 16, that it was the coldest night in his memory, and that our snowman outside was frozen solid. Minutes later, it seemed, I was awakened by someone shaking me. Atticus's overcoat was spread across me.
Is it morning already?
Baby, get up. Atticus was holding out my bathrobe and coat. Put your robe on first, he said. Jem was standing beside Atticus, groggy and tousled. He was holding his overcoat closed at the neck. His other hand was jammed into his pocket. He looked strangely overweight.
Hurry, hon, said Atticus. Here are your shoes and socks.
Stupidly, I put them on.
Is it morning?
No, it's a little after one. Hurry now.
That something was wrong finally got through to me.
What's the matter?
By then, he did not have to tell me. Just as the birds know where to go when it rains, I knew when there was trouble in our street. Soft, taffeta-like sounds and muffled scurrying sounds filled me with helpless dread.
Whose is it?
Miss Morty's, hon, said Atticus gently. At the front door we saw fire spewing from Miss Morty's dining room windows.
As if to confirm what we saw, the town fire siren wailed up the scale to a treble pitch and remained there screaming.
It's gone, ain't it? Moaned Jem.
I expect so, said Atticus. Now listen, both of you. Go down and stand in front of the Radley place. Keep out of the way, do you hear? See which way the wind's blowing?
Oh, said Jem. Atticus, reckon we ought to start moving the furniture out?
Not yet, son. Do as I tell you. Run now. Take care of Scout, you hear? Don't let her out of your sight.